Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
Hey everyone, welcome to Nowhere to Run. Thank you for tuning in however you found it, whether it's on the Revere Radio Network, Revelations Radio Network, Black Vault Radio Network, iTunes, various podcast sites, YouTube, surfing around the internet, forums. Thank you, however you found it. You can go to the website, which is nowheretorunradio.com, and you can find my other shows at revelationsradionetwork.com. They are The Full Armor of God and The Frank and Chris Show, which is live every Wednesday night. First, I'm going to play the audio from a video that I just got done doing called The Face and Pyramids on Mars Debunked. And I'll just go ahead and play that, and I'll talk about it here in a second.
But I have taken an excerpt from one of the last editions of Cosmic Conspiracy, updated a bit, and put it in there to explain about that asteroid belt and about the surface of Mars and why half of it has crud all over it and why there's a long gash in it. It was either a small planet, a planetoid, about 300 to 600 miles in diameter that occupied the what is now the asteroid belt, or there was a moon about that size and a planet together there. But it broke up, whether it was due to the spin of the sun changing, slowing down, which closes out gravitational orbits. Planets orbit where they have to. They can't orbit arbitrarily at some radius around the sun. They have to be in a null gravitational zone between the divergent and convergent waves coming out from the spin center of the sun's gravity. So we think the asteroid belt is in transit at the moment. It's being broken up because the layer that used to form a null where a planet could hold that orbit is now closing out, where the divergent convergent waves are canceling, which means that the planet broke up because it could no longer be supported because it was being sheared by the gravitational changes. And it, whether it was the planetoid or a moon of it, ended up bouncing out of that orbit and hitting the surface of Mars. And you'll see that the surface of Mars has a lot of red dust on it, which is not indigenous to the planet. It is off-world junk, which probably came from this breakup. The gash on the surface of Mars, it impacts and spreads out like an impact cone, if you wish, like a long triangular cone. And the face on Mars, a farce, as I call it, by all these people trying to tell us it was a face in that debris and everything. If you look at the satellite photos that NASA has, early ones and later ones, you will see that all of those crystalline shapes like pyramids in that area, and even the face piece itself, are on pieces or large pieces of a curved surface that impacted and unfolded on the surface of Mars. Planets and planetoids, when they cool, form, and this is no, you know, secret, it's like the Earth has it too, there are mountains of mass underneath the Earth, you know, on the surface, that connect to the surface but point down like structures into the Earth as it cools, and it crystallizes. And so these are large crystalline structures that were formed inside of a 300 to 600 mile diameter object that impacted, broke apart, and it impacted reasonably slowly. It was first trapped, as the dust was, in an orbit around Mars. The orbit decayed. It wasn't a high-speed thing, in other words. And it impacted on the surface of Mars relatively slowly, which then allowed the sphere to break and its innards be exposed to the surface of the planet and become like pyramids or crystalline structures. And the evidence is there. Even the curl of the plate, which was originally the surface of the planetoid, helped us to determine the curved radius of the structure that hit. And then looking at the mass, which is distributed around, you can kind of put all those together and estimate the size of the mass. So I think we'll find water on Mars, and a lot of it. And I think we'll find a lot of other things buried on Mars, which would be quite an interest to us. Once you get past all the red dust that came as a result of the planetary breakup, or planet breakup and orbital moon orbit, in the asteroid belt. That's a long way to answer your question, but go and look at Face of Mars PDF I've got, and I've got pictures in there to explain in better detail than what I just did what I think happened there and why the evidence displays that.
Okay, well, I thought I would talk a little candidly about this whole situation and what I think is happening and what that's all about. For most of you, or some of you, would know that I have in the past kind of tentatively held the position that this might be, that the Cydonia region on Mars with the pyramids and the face and all that could have been from like a pre-Adamic, like angelic race, as David Flynn postulates and things like that. And I've pretty much held that for a while, kind of tentatively, as I said. And then I got an email from somebody saying, you know, hey, my brother thinks it's an absolute fact that there's, you know, was a former civilization on Mars. You know, what do you think about it? And I was like, you know, I don't really know. I'll look into it because I remembered having this interview with Standeo, and I never really looked at that PDF file he was talking about. So I looked at it, and it was just from his book Cosmic Conspiracy, and it was a good theory. It really actually doesn't need the crystals part of it. You know, looking at the brand new pictures of the Cydonia region, I mean, it's clearly not, you know, anything. It could. I mean, I think the crystalline structures still could play a part, but really the thing that theory has going for it is the, you know, the angles and everything and the plates and all that stuff, you know, crystals notwithstanding, whatever it is in the middle of the planet is what's been scattered over there. So I think that it's a really, really good point. Looking back now at all these things that, you know, Richard Hoagland, I don't know, I was going to do like a video on Richard Hoagland and some of the things that he says. I just got done watching like a 3-hour Project Camelot video that he does where, I mean, it is like so obviously New World Order mindset, New Age, everything down to the last letter. I mean, he's got all the major components of please believe the New World Order mystery school version of history, and he even goes through the whole thing. I mean, in his version of history about NASA, I mean, he says, and this is why I thought I was going to get along with him. He's like, well, NASA's, you know, it's basically the Nazis, the Masons, and the magicians. They're all running it. And I was like, well, you know, that kind of jives with what I've seen. But then, in his version, the Masons are the super, super good guys. And if you watch that thing, at one point, he says that they're Christians, that they are the Christians. And he was building up to it the whole time. He's like, you know, like they always do. It's like, you know, it's these fundamental groups that are just, you know, they're really holding us back. And it's this old kind of mindset that, you know, you're just like, come on, just say it. And so finally, when he's talking about they, and he just got done saying it was the Nazis and, you know, Operation Paperclip and all this stuff. So I'm like, okay. And then he's like, and, you know, it's just that these people, the reason they don't want us to know about the face is because, you know, it would just, you know, it would make their gods, and everybody has their own gods, and even their own Bible. It's like, oh, gotcha. We know who they are to you now. It's the Christians. That's who doesn't want everybody to know about the face, and he's just got all this anger in that regard. So I think that should be the telltale sign. Not if anybody has hook'em horns. I think we should, the gotcha is if they have like virulent hatred toward Christianity. That should be the suspicious thing here in the truth movement. But anyway, enough about him. So I got to looking back at this whole situation, and one of the things that intrigued me was all this supposed geometry and how it all matched up with, you know, perfectly at these angles and matched up with these other places on Earth and all this stuff. And I found those points, those anchor points, to be very arbitrary. If you go back and look at Richard Hoagland's, you know, where he's got all the lines drawn from that one, you know, so-called star pyramid, and it's got, you know, it's spreading out to all the other places, and there's angles, and it just looks real scientific. But you go back and look at that, or the Fibonacci sequence thing, I don't know if I pronounced that right, you know, with a little squiggly mathematical line that's on shells and sunflowers or whatever. Well, anyway, so, yeah, that whole thing doesn't seem to be at all accurate. It's like anchored at totally random places. It seems to be right on line with the other part, you know, the star pyramid, but then the anchoring points are just, it just looks cool. And then And I'll talk about David Flynn in a second. I think David Flynn's okay, and I'll tell you why in a second. But I was rewatching that presentation with him and everything, and he was using. Okay, here's an interesting connection. I encourage you to check this out. So I saw one of the things that David Flynn uses in regards to Cydonia, which I think that he could just be wrong about, because everything else is interesting. I'll get to that in a second. But, you know, one of these things that he said, and if you match this up to, you know, this, you're going to, you know, this place in Cydonia up with this place in Earth. I think he was talking about Avebury, the region there in England. Then it, you know, matches or something like that. And he was using something from David S. Percy, I think it was. And if you Google, like, David S. Percy and Richard Hoagland and the Council of Nine, you'll come up with a really interesting article that I originally came across on Red Ice Creations. But these guys are all tied into, and the Face on Mars thing even, is tied into some really weird stuff that went down with, like, Andrzej Jabuharik and some weird stuff with, like, Uri Geller and channeling, you know, the Council of Nine, and this was all something that it's a long, long, weird story that has ties to the military and ties to mind control and ties to a lot of stuff. But the Face on Mars is tied in there, too. And so I think that's weird in itself. And the thing about it, and then I kept watching more about Richard Hoagland and stuff like that, and his whole bag seems to be these pictures that he's like, I've, you know, thing that changes the world, here it is, you know, and he's got to spend like 7 hours explaining to you what it is because it's not there if you just looked at it. I mean, everything that I've ever seen from him, I mean, I'm like, you know, I don't see it. It's like, you don't see it because you're not trained to see it. But it's not there. I mean, especially, it's weird. Even in the David Flynn presentation with Cydonia, he's only using the old Viking images to do that stuff because it's not there. I mean, it's not there. And so what about David Flynn? Because I know, I recently did the debunking 2012 thing too, and that, you know, came up a lot too. It was like, well, what about David Flynn? He talks a lot about 2012. So what do I think about David Flynn? Well, I just got done watching two of his presentations last night. I didn't watch one of them that may have probably been the one I should have watched. But, and this is all coming from his video presentations on Google, basically from the Ancient of Days conferences over a few years. And I got the impression that he may have been, I know for a fact that he looks up to Richard Hoagland. And that kind of got him started in a lot of this stuff, trying to figure it out and stuff like that. And the kind of personality that he has, I know of some people like that, that, you know, once they get on a trail like that, they start to, you know, really be able to research and apply a lot of things and make a lot of things fit and make connections where there are none. So I think he might have just been off about Cydonia. But the majority of his presentations are showing the interesting connections on the Earth, all from essentially like a mystery school Masonic perspective. And that, to some people I know, is suspicious. And even to me, I was like, well, you know, that's kind of weird because he's obviously using all the Hermetic data and all the esoteric knowledge and stuff to basically say these presentations. And I know that sounds like, well, you know, you shouldn't be doing all that. But I think what my perception of what he's done is he kind of decoded all these quote-unquote secret knowledge of the Masonic mystery schools and just kind of put it out there. You know, this is what they believe. You know, I figured it out kind of thing. And I think he does it kind of unapologetically. Like, you know, he tells us what it is. And I think he makes that pretty clear. This is their deal. And I think in regards to 2012, his pointing to it as a significant date is pointing to it through esoteric knowledge and saying essentially they have high reverence for this day. And he does know and has said there, and I, you know, I just watched this in his presentation where he says, you know, the whole procession cycle is just a viewpoint thing. We're always quote unquote in line with galactic center. This will just be a viewpoint thing, and this is you know, that it's significant to them, you know, going back a long time, And so I think that he's just, again, like kind of like Bill Cooper, just laying it down the line what they believe. And he says at the end of one of those presentations, he says, you know, this whole thing may edify your belief if you're already like a Gnostic or whatever, but to me it shows that there's going to be this is going to be used as a deception in the end times, which is probably going to coincide with this time period. And then he made a really interesting connection that I think really solidified a view that's been coming together since I did the 2012 movie. And it is this. He was showing this thing about the Ouroboros, or I think that's how you pronounce it, essentially this thing that they believe looks like a serpent eating its tail, which a lot of Masonic and mystery school symbolism has to do with. And it has to do with these points where, you know, these constellations would be at that certain time, at that certain place. Well, there's this interesting connection to what happens when the Ouroboros crosses this bird that's represented as a phoenix that seems to be at this very time, in December 21st, 2012, the phoenix would be rising out of the ashes of this fire. You know, it's all this symbolism that they had. Now, that kind of, you know, from the perspective that we've been looking into or whatever, what they believe the phoenix rising out of the ashes is essentially the Antichrist, their awaited Messiah that they just are giddy with excitement about is coming. They see him rising out of the ashes of chaos, Order Ab Kal. And every time you see that Order Ab Kal, you'll see a phoenix rising out of the ashes. And so what I'm saying is, I'm combining this with the recent thing about Mark Blitz. And if you have not seen Mark Blitz's presentations or whatever, please check it out. You can go to Google Video, type in Mark Blitz, B-L-I-T-Z, I think, and watch his presentation on the Blood Moons situation. And what's significant about that is that he shows that 2015 is significant for a lot of reasons on the Jewish calendar and the sun and the moon and star and things like that. I won't go into it. You know, you can have your presuppositions about whatever it is. He explains it all very well, I think. But my point is that if 2012 is some kind of satanic thing, which I think that the Luciferian, Masonic, all that knowledge, esoteric knowledge that came from the Nephilim, came from the Watchers, was demonically charged and empowered and is the same, the driving force behind a lot of the esoteric societies that are doing a lot of the evil in the world. I think that at 2012, in and around December 21st, 2012, the Antichrist will come on the scene and make peace. And it'll be peace that has to do with enlightenment. And it'll be the kind of peace that is like no mere, like, oh yeah, it'll be like all the problems are going to seem to be solved. And I don't really know a lot of ways to do that except for just, you know, seriously miraculous stuff going on. It could be have to do with aliens, it could not, whatever, it doesn't really matter, but I think that the reason December 21st, 2012 is a Masonic, and more than Masonic, it's a Luciferian marker. But what's interesting is that 3.5 years from then is when you find all this stuff in 2015 that looks like, and Mark Blitz's point is not, this is not going to be the rapture or anything. What he's looking towards is the actual, the scriptural indications that Jesus Christ will be putting his foot down on the Mount of Olives and coming back to rule in and around that area. And that's, it's not date setting, it's not anything like that. It's when you look into it, you're like, wow, this is, there are a lot of clues. I don't think the Holy Spirit puts things in the Bible there for no reason. There's a lot of clues over and over and over again, enough to be confirmed and reconfirmed and reconfirmed. And so I would encourage you to check that out. But basically, this is a scenario then. If this whole build-up to 2012 is the reason that's why they're pushing it on everybody, is because they can, they will get them all worked up, and then, you know, in the meantime, there's going to be tremendous chaos caused by, of course, by religion and Barack Obama and his support of Israel and all this stuff. So we're going to hate Judeo-Christian religions, everybody's going to be worked up with their hatred. It's the problem. Religion is the problem, blah, 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 blah. And I think that at the end, around 2012, Antichrist will show up with a false peace, but that false peace won't last too long. And there'll be 3.5 years of super trouble. And then our Lord Jesus Christ comes back at an in and around 2015. That is not date setting. I think that, you know, before you say, no man knows the day or the hour, I agree with you 100%. And I also think that there's some interesting things like, you know, the Jewish wedding, stuff like that, that's worth looking into. But I'll leave that to Mark Blitz. Take a really quick break here, and I'll get into something else on the other side.
Russ Dizdar explains his ministry, Shatter the Darkness.
Almost 20 years now, we've been just kind of just trying to help people, minister to people, share with people coming out of cults, you know, just mind control, the occult, left-hand path stuff. And then we ran into the real underground that's been going on for a long time. And so it has a lot to do with deliverance and dealing with the dark side and power encounters. And, you know, it has confronting perpetrators of violence on children and ritual abuse. It deals with healing the hearts of the victims and, you know, keeping our guard and trying to do what we can to expose it, stop some of it.
You can visit Russ Dizdar's website at shatterthedarkness.net, where you'll find hours of free MP3s and podcasts, as well as courses for your church or your ministry to begin to learn how to deal with encounters of this nature in a biblical way. Shatterthedarkness.net.
The Jew could not mean that kind of God. God, in their language, meant the being outside the world who made it and was infinitely different from anything else. And when you have grasped that, you will see that what this man said was, quite simply, the most shocking thing that has ever been uttered by human lips. One part of the claim tends to slip past us unnoticed because we have heard it so often that we no longer see what it amounts to. I mean the claim to forgive sins, any sins. Now, unless the speaker is God, this is really so preposterous as to be comic. We can all understand how a man forgives offenses against himself. You tread on my toe and I forgive you. You steal my money and I forgive you. But what should we make of a man, himself unrobbed and untrodden on, who announced that he forgave you for treading on other men's toes and stealing other men's money? Asinine fatuity is the kindest description we should give of his conduct. And yet this is what Jesus did. He told people that their sins were forgiven and never waited to consult all the other people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He unhesitatingly behaved as if he was the party chiefly concerned, the person chiefly offended in all offenses. Now, this makes sense only if he really was the God whose laws are broken and whose love is wounded in every sin. In the mouth of any speaker who is not God, these words would imply what I can only regard as a silliness and conceit unrivaled by any other character in history. Yet, and this is the strange, significant thing, even his enemies, when they read the Gospels, do not usually get the impression of silliness and conceit. Still less do unprejudiced readers. Christ says that he is humble and meek, and we believe him, not noticing that, if he were merely a man, humility and meekness are the very last characteristics we could attribute to some of his sayings. I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to.
Let's go to Chris first. He disagrees first. Chris in Tennessee, go ahead. Hey, I'll try to go really quickly. I've looked into this and have found that there's an elaborate psyop that I think that has everything to do with the chaos that they want to come through this future world war to bring in the new system. And I think that the elites, even the so-called Jews, have a deep-rooted anger and hatred for the Old Testament believing Jewish people. I know you know that, and the ringworm children and all that. But they say one thing and do another. It's like the American border Minutemen thing, and all the politicians say, you know, defend Israel, you know, nuke Iran, but our actions are totally opposite, and we fund their enemies to the teeth, and, you know, the AP is...
No. The United States... Well, I agree. I don't know what we're disagreeing about.
Let me get to the final thing. It's really, really thing. But I do think, and I know you agree on all this, that they have us brainwashed to think Bush is a Christian, and that's why America is obliged to join this coming deadly war, which, even if he was a Christian, the Bible doesn't say to support Israel militarily, you know, it says to bless them. But anyway... that in itself is a propagated lie, but here it is. I think that this World War III is coming, is going to be blamed, just as Albert Pike said, on the Judeo-Christian religion, so that they can blame everything, you know, just like the Holden Truth Movement is saying, you know, they're putting it in our minds that religion is the enemy, you know, you've got to fight against religion.
No, I mean, certainly the people in all these groups and the leaders in Israel are Illuminist, and that is their religion, and that's what the Rothschilds funded that new... you know, Israeli Supreme Court with a giant all-seeing eye over it, and I agree, and I'm saying it's multinational evil, but I'm saying still, it is outrageous. You know, I mean, if we had British, you know, intelligence operatives, I mean, don't you agree we shouldn't have Rahm Emanuel and Chertoff and Mukasey? And of course, people are meant to see that. That's what I said, is that it's meant to create all this anger, and then that creates this this dialectic. Because then the globalists then also create the anti-Israel fervor and run those groups. And I said, that's why I'm not with those groups. But I'm stating what's happening, and I'm not denying that it's going on.
Yeah, I just think that like they were painting Bush to be a Christian, they're going to paint Barack Obama to be, you know, at all costs defending Israel, so they'll have a good reason to say, you know, this is why we've gone into war, this is all our problem, look what it's caused us, blah, 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 you know, because the new war is going to be...
Yes, it's very, very sophisticated. The New World Order is very, very sophisticated, and I appreciate your call. Now, I don't do any of this.
All right. That was me calling into Alex Jones there, and it really didn't disagree with him. I just really wanted to say that for the people listening, you know, because it's such a weird, very sophisticated, as you said, thing. I mean, they are appointing Jewish people, I think, to make it so obvious that we're, you know, that he's going to just support Israel at all costs, to be such a blame game thing, knowing, of course, that there's really no difference between their government and our government. I mean, their governments are New World Order governments, and so in the same way that, you know, we're totally almost all New World Order, they're all New World Order. It doesn't matter what nationality you are. But they know that it matters what nationality they are to us. And they're not stupid, and they know that people, even people that, you know, are just kind of waking up to this, because even the mainstream people are starting to wake up to this, and they'll get woken up to a paradigm of Zionists, woken up to a paradigm of whatever it may be, which will eventually, after all this time, create the anti-Judeo-Christian sentiment they will need to bring in this atheistic superstate with a hatred of Christianity and Judaism, and to a lesser extent, probably Islam. So, on the Frank and Chris Show, we had a discussion about whether or not the beasts in Revelation 13 could be speaking of nations or people. We had a caller that said, and a friend, who said that the beasts in Revelation were speaking of two different nations, and that one of them seemed to be obviously a nation, and one of them seemed to be obviously a person, and the idea was they can't be, it would be inconsistent. Interestingly, I think this audio clip answers all of those questions. It doesn't do it right off the bat. It may not seem like it's going to right off the bat, because the initial idea here is that these two beasts are the false prophet and the Antichrist. And in this scenario, they would be both men. And there are, in fact, times in Daniel where it does use the term beast for kings, and you can go follow that word back. I mean, it says it clearly that they're kings. I hear that you can use kings and kingdom interchangeably, but you can go back and look at those times that the word king was used in that context in Daniel and find that it was, in fact, talking about singular kings. But notwithstanding, this is a completely other thing, a different thing, and this is extremely exciting. If you like Bible studies, this is just like really exciting Bible study. It's just Chuck Missler has a way of just really making you want to learn more about the Bible. And he just makes it come alive. So if you're like, oh, great, a Bible study, stay tuned. This is one Bible study you might be like, you know, I think I could actually sit through Bible studies like that. So I think this is a good starting place for our discussion maybe next Wednesday night about what indeed these beasts are. And could they both be, as Chuck Missler suggests, kind of idioms in both ways, too? I'll just leave it to him. And just stick with them for a little while. It's only about an hour long, and it's really informative, at least in a lot of different ways, actually. So here we go. In the meantime,
verse by verse study, chapter by chapter study of the book of Revelation. We are in Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. As we embarked on the third and major section of the book of Revelation, which began at chapter 6, we of course encountered the seven sealed book, and as the seals were broken, we got to the seventh seal, which ushered in seven trumpets. And as those seven trumpets were blown, we finally get to the seventh trumpet, which introduces, is of course going to introduce the seven bowls of God's judgment, but it also introduces something that may not be as conspicuously evident, but is still there, our seven personages. The occasion of the seventh trumpet blowing involves an introduction, an overview, sort of a recap series of chapters. Chapters 10, 11, and 12, 13, 14 are sort of an interlude, an explanatory interlude of an overview of what's going on. It has introduced seven personages. The woman, which we talked about last time. The man-child, the woman brings forth. And the red dragon, clearly identified as Satan in chapter 12, verse 9. Michael the archangel and the remnant of Israel. And there are two left to make the complete seven. These two that we're going to get introduced to now are in chapter 13. So let's just jump in. I might mention in chapter 13, I want you to notice there are two people. Two people. So many of us constantly talk about this coming world leader. And I prefer to use that term rather than the common one, because the common one tends to be a little misleading in ways. We speak of the Antichrist. Literature for 1900 years, even secular literature, is full of this comments and expectation of a person called the Antichrist. Well, the first thing to understand is that there are two people. It's a duet. And that's very clear in this particular chapter. One of the puzzling enigmas about this coming world leader, is he a Gentile or is he a Jew? You can make a list of passages which imply that he's a Gentile. And you can also make a list of passages which clearly indicate, or suggest at least, that he's Jewish. And therein lies one of the many controversies surrounding these passages. Well, one of the first things to recognize that may help resolve this is that there are two guys, not one. And so I mentioned that right up front as we jump in. The first 10 verses are of this particular person called here in chapter 13, the beast, sometimes known as the first beast of Revelation 13. The two guys together, if you assemble all the references, there are 33 different titles alluding to these two guys in the Old Testament alone, and 13 in the New. And so many of these titles will be very familiar to you if you're a serious student. Some of them are a little more subtle. But in any case, one other thing I might mention. Since I opened the subject, I should probably deal with, that's this whole term, the Antichrist. The Antichrist. Now, that has such a charged emotional content to it, I prefer to avoid it, because the Antichrist sounds sinister, evil, and so forth. And he certainly is, don't misunderstand me. But that term masks his attractiveness. This is not some guy the world is going to fear. This is some guy the world is going to embrace with joy, with excitement, with a sense of cosmic fulfillment. And so the idea of Antichrist is a strange term for that. That's why I've just tend to use personally the term the coming world leader, because it's more neutral in that regard. The term Antichrist itself is misleading. It comes from the Greek. The word anti in the Greek means over and against. And it can mean an adversarial situation. It can also mean in the place of. And that's its meaning here. Someone who puts himself in the place of Christ. When you use the term Antichrist, it sounds like an adversary, that he's an equal antagonist opposing him. Well, first of all, he's not equal at all. He's going to get wiped out by the breath of the Lord's mouth. But also the term, even though he obviously is against Christ, the term really is intended to connote the idea he presents himself in the place of Christ. The anti term comes from the Greek. The Latin equivalent to that term is the term vicar, the substitute for, in place of. And of course there is one on the face of the earth that for many centuries has proudly emblazoned that title on his vestments, the vicar of Christ, namely the Pope. Many, many centuries, the Pope was viewed as the Antichrist. It may surprise you to learn that I don't believe the Pope is the Antichrist in the sense most people think of him that way. We're going to deal with that in chapter 17 when we get there, in ways that I'm sure will be guaranteed. We'll have something to offend everyone when we get into that material. For that reason, it's interesting that the term Antichrist shows up in the Bible in John's epistles. His first and second epistles use the term Antichrist, but it's used in a different way. He speaks of the spirit of Antichrist as being already present. The spirit of Antichrist is what John uses. It intrigues me that in the book of Revelation, penned by John, he never uses that term. He uses several other terms, as we'll see, but it's interesting that Paul, in his epistles, uses different terms, the son of perdition, and so forth. But so that, as I say, there's 33 labels you can choose from. By popular usage, we tend to use the term Antichrist. It won't go away, but I want us to at least be sensitive to the shortcomings of that particular label. And let's just move on. Chapter 13, verse 1. John says, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns. And upon his horns, ten crowns. And upon his heads, the name of blasphemy." Now the word here, the beast, is therion. We encountered the word, the King James uses the term beast in chapter 4. It's a different, the word there is zoa, living creature. Here the word is in fact therion in the Greek. It is what we think of as a beast, someone that's frightening, terrible, and in fact loathsome. So it's a beast of prey, if you will. And in contrast to the term living creature, as it should have been translated in chapter 4 and 5. The word beast here appears, this is interesting to me, 36 times. That's 6 squared. 6 times 6 is 36. It intrigues me that the term occurs 36 times. I mentioned that that's a big deal, but as you get into this, the study, you begin to realize there are subtleties of design that manifest its supernatural origin. And that's the only reason I bring that up. Now, this particular beast, it's a vision, but is seen as coming out of the sea. And if you've done your homework in Old Testament prophecy, you know that the sea is very often used as an idiom for the nations. The wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt, and on and on. You could quote probably a dozen passages where the sea in its turmoil is used as a biblical idiom for the nations or the heathen or the world, the Gentile world at large. In contrast to Eretz Israel, the earth, and the second beast comes up out of the earth, you'll see. And so the point is, that's why many commentators believe that the first of these two characters is a Gentile. It comes out of the sea. That would be consistent with that view. Not conclusive, but at least it's interesting and a possibility. And it's Isaiah 57, verse 20 and 21, for those of you that want to chase down the other thing I just quoted. But there's something else we should keep in mind that is not obvious from chapter 13, but if your memory is good, you may recall when we were in chapter 11, verse 7, because there is the first time this beast is mentioned. And it says, "The beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them." In other words, there's an allusion in Revelation chapter 11, verse 7. In fact, the first place this beast is mentioned, but it's mentioned as if you knew about him already, that he ascends out of the abuso, which attests to some form of supernatural aspect to him. He obviously is demonically driven. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to indicate, in fact, I think it expressly says so even in this chapter, that Satan indwells him. It's one thing to be demon-possessed. It's quite another to have Satan focus his personal attention on the mission. So we should be alert to that. Now, there's another thing that mentioned in Revelation 11:7 that we're going to talk about when we get to verse 8 in chapter 13. And that's the fact that he overcomes the saints. Very strange indication. We get that from Daniel. We get that from Revelation 11. We get that Revelation 13. And that gives us a clue to a doctrinal issue that may surprise you. But we'll hold that off until we get to verse 8. Now, the second beast, when we get to verse 11, chapter 13, comes from the earth. I'll take it now, just while we have this in parallel here. Verse 11, I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb. That is, the horns are authority. He had authority like the lamb. Yet he spoke like the dragon. So apparently he manifests authority as the Messiah, and yet his words and doctrine and so forth are satanic. And he's a religious type leader, it would seem, and we'll develop that as we go. But from Ezekiel 28, it implies he is of the circumcision, meaning he's Jewish. In this first verse, we have these seven heads and ten horns. The crowns are on the horns, not the head. Now, it's hard to visualize us if you're trying to draw it, but bear in mind, this is a vision, and the idioms there, of course, are allusions from the Old Testament. The crowns are the worship, but they derive from the authority, not their kingship. Seven heads and ten horns. This thing has echoed through the scriptures all the way through. You've seen it hundreds of times. It all derives. One of the places to start a study of this would be Daniel 7. And I think we'll have the time, so let's depart and pick up this background. We frequently study Daniel 2 and 7 because they are the unique places in the scripture where all of Gentile history is laid out. The Bible usually talks about history through the lens of Israel, but there are two exceptions to that, Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, much studied for that reason. But in Daniel 7, we're also treated to some very special prophetic insights. Just as Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2 saw the series of four metals, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, then finally iron mixed with clay, representing the four empires from Babylon through Persia, Greece, and Rome, likewise, in Daniel 7, Daniel sees four beasts rise up out of the sea. Again, the sea is used as the idiom or the canvas upon which this painting is painted, so to speak. Four of them come up in verse 3. The first one's like a lion in verse 4, and then in verse 5, another like a bear. And then 6, we have the leopard, four wings on its back. We won't take the time tonight, but if you go through those carefully, they're clearly the same empires that are Babylon, Persia, then Greece, and then Rome. In fact, Daniel is going to amplify the Greek situation in chapter 8 and chapter 11. Well, chapter 8 in such detail that when Alexander entered Jerusalem, they showed him this. He recognized himself and spared the city. So the prophecies of Daniel have an incredible, incredible background. But it's this fourth beast that interests us because this fourth beast goes in two phases. Obviously, phase one was the ancient Roman Empire that broke into pieces, but will be reassembled. In fact, is being reassembled in our day. In the last 30 years, that's been happening. But what's going to happen, looking at verse 8, Daniel says, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn. In other words, there were 10 horns. There's an 11th that shows up. It's called the little horn, before which there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes, like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, I have a peculiar idiosyncrasy. As I look through the prophecies of Daniel, I look through the epistles of Paul, and I look through the writings of John in Revelation, you find, as I say, 33 titles of the Antichrist in the Old Testament, 13 in the New. But the label that I would use that comes up more often than any of them is one that's not in that list. And that is that he's always shooting off his mouth. You see it here, and it sounds like I'm being flippant, and I'm not really. But all through Thessalonians, the 2 Thessalonians 2 chapter, and you'll see in Revelation, the Holy Spirit always points out that he has a mouth speaking great things. This guy is a real orator, but maybe far more than that. But the point is, if I was going to give him a label, I would call him Mr. Big Mouth. But I don't. I know that really won't fly, especially in scholastic circles. But I'll just leave it as I'll leave it as a footnote. And then, of course, it's interesting that we then have the kingdom being set up and so forth. But when you get to verse 15, it's interesting how Daniel, he saw the vision. That's what we've talked about so far. But from verse 15 on, the vision gets interpreted for us. But it fascinates me that Daniel wasn't concerned about the earlier portions. It's as if he understood those. But it's interesting, starting in verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. And I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. And he told me and made me know the interpretation of these things. These great beasts, which are four kings or kingdoms. Same word in the Aramaic and Hebrew. Melech is either a king or a kingdom, depending on context. Who shall rise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. And so that's the final conclusion, of course. Then here, verse 19, Daniel asks questions only about the fourth beast. And I would know the truth of the fourth beast. He doesn't worry about one, two, and three. It's the fourth one. Which was diverse from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and stamped the residue with his feet. And of the 10 horns that were in its head, and of the other which came up, in other words, the 11th, and before them three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, here it is again, whose look was more stout than its fellows. And I beheld the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. I want you to notice we find it here in Daniel 7:21. You'll find it in Revelation 11 and Revelation 13, that this leader prevails over the saints. That should give you a problem. Because in Matthew 16, Jesus Christ promised that the gates of hell would not prevail, same word, overcome, nikeo in the Greek, the church. And what you're going to discover is that not all saints are in the church. There are saints. There are Old Testament saints. And there are also saints in the book of Revelation that are not necessarily the church. The term elect, the term saints, is a broad term. But within that category are subcategories. That's one of the most tragic aspects of our level of ignorance in eschatology is not ignorance of end time prophecies, ignorance of the mystery of the church. Most people don't understand what the church is really all about. But let's move on right now. Verse 23, he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all the kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth. The whole earth. So essentially, I wouldn't take that exhaustively, but this is a global thing, not a European thing. And it shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns, verse 24, out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise. These shall arise. They're not 10 that make it up. They arise out of it. And another shall rise up after them. And he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High. There it is again. This is an attribute that's more than just a descriptor. It's an identity piece. It's a very key part. And he shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change the times and the laws. Why would he think to change the times and the laws? That's been tried many times in history quite unsuccessfully. And I happened to be doing my research in weapons effects for a book I'm writing. And I didn't realize, I thought it through, I discovered that in the Russian arsenal there are a few 100-megaton bombs. Now most hydrogen bombs are 1 to 4 megaton. That's a very, very practical, very large warhead. A 100-megaton bomb is so big it's hard to figure out what you'd use it for. But if you do the calculations, a handful of those fired at the same time would alter the orbit of the Earth. And one wild speculation, but it's interesting, would be that the earthquake in Ezekiel 38 that God uses to intervene on behalf of Israel during the Magog invasion might cause an orbital change which will require our calendar modified. That's off the wall, but I share it with you only to stretch your imaginations as to what might be going on here. Change the times and the laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time times the dividing of time. This is a rhetorical way of saying 3.5 years. Time is singular, times is a dual, not a plural, a dual in this case. Time times and the dividing of time are half. It's like saying 1 plus 2.5. And that period of time, of course, we're going to encounter again and again and again about this period of time. It's the most documented period of time in the Bible. We'll come back to that when we get back to Revelation. But finishing this off, verse 26, but the judgment shall sit, and then they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. And, of course, it finishes up, of course, with the kingdom being established. Back to Revelation, and with these idioms in your mind, when you count Revelation 13, first verse, I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. It all ties together. There were originally ten, he pulled down three, leaving seven. Seven heads, ten horns. Then it continues. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, and his feet was like a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Now, it's interesting, those three idioms were the three idioms used by Daniel for the first three beasts. In other words, he had similarities to those. It's interesting that the order is backwards, because Daniel is looking forward and John's looking back. But the same three idioms are there, a leopard, a bear, and a lion. But who gives him the power? It says, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. Who's the dragon? Previous chapter, chapter 12, verse 9, says the dragon was Satan. Clearly identified. Satan empowers this guy. That means he is really powerful. He's not just a guy with charisma. He's not just a guy that is by being at the right place at the right time and has the right backers. No, no, it's deeper than that. This guy probably will have supernatural gifts of substantial kinds. And I don't think anyone's ready for that. Verse 3, and I saw one of his heads as though it were wounded to the death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Now, we come to this whole controversy about his head wound. All through the scripture, kings and kingdoms are used as synonyms. And it's pretty easy in the Old Testament to understand it. In the New Testament, again, we have this beast. Is it a person or is it an organization? Answer, it's probably both. It's probably both. And yet, when you have a head wound, and as you read the text, most scholars are convinced that it is, whatever else it also is, it's a person. Because he has a head wound and is apparently killed. I'm among those that believe he's not really killed. Because he's going to end up being healed. And the world's going to be flabbergasted when he's resurrected. And I believe because only Jesus Christ has the keys of hell and of death, that either God gives him some kind of special permission, or more likely, it is a fraud. It is one of Satan's counterfeits. Books are filled with scholars, theologians arguing that point, but it's really academic because even if it is a counterfeit, it's a perfect one in the sense that it deceives everybody. No one can deceive like Satan can deceive. And if he wants a resurrection, he can fabricate a resurrection that's so flawless that it would fool any of us. So that the technicality is probably a moot point in a sense. But this head wound is so important that it's used as an identity three times in this chapter alone. So it becomes not just an event that occurs, so to speak, but it becomes a major part of his identity. He has a head wound. Verse 4, it says, and they worshiped the dragon, that is Satan, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Now, let's remember where the beast came from. Chapter 11, verse 7, and also we'll discover again in chapter 17, verse 8, the beast comes out of the Abuso. So there clearly is a major supernatural dimension to him in the first place. He's not just some political figure that might be prominent on the horizon. I wouldn't wait, for other reasons I'll come to, I wouldn't waste your time trying to guess who he is. Verse 5. And there was given unto him, here it is again, a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. See, there again, it's not only a fact that's true, it's almost another one of these identities, because it comes up so frequently. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. The 70th week of Daniel is split into two halves, 3.5 years each. Each half of that period of time is labeled every conceivable way the Holy Spirit could find. It's labeled half a week. It's labeled 3.5 years. It's labeled time times the dividing of time, a rhetorical way of saying the same thing. It's called 42 months. And it's called 1260 days. 42 times 30, okay. See, so the point is, the Holy Spirit did everything but put it in hours and minutes for you. So, and I believe he did that because he wants us to understand that's not symbolic or allegorical. It's a literal period of time. That seven-year period, especially the last half of that seven-year period, is the most documented period of time in the entire Bible. And the Lord apparently has real good reason for that. Verse 6, and he opened his mouth, here it is again, in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And of course, the pinnacle of his blasphemy is when he actually sets up his own image in the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem to be worshipped. And that egregious act has a technical term. It's called the abomination of desolation. I think we've spoken on it many times. It happened in 167 B.C. as a historical marker, if you will. 2 centuries later, Jesus alludes to it, but yet future, as the trigger point for the most important period in end-time prophecy, when 4 disciples come to him privately for that confidential briefing recorded in Matthew 24 and 25, Luke 21 and 22, and Mark 13 and 14, the so-called Olivet Discourse. The key to that entire passage is this event called the Abomination of Desolation, which is Jesus' way of pointing you back to Daniel 9 and 12 and other allusions in the book of Daniel that detail that. A very specific event yet to happen. It requires a temple to happen. The temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD under conditions of war, and there was no opportunity there for it to be desecrated. It was taken apart, literally. It was not used as a place for false worship. And that's exactly what the abomination of desolation implies. The abomination means idol worship. The abomination of desolation is the ultimate form, the most offensive form of idol worship, namely putting an idol in the most sacred spot on the planet Earth. In Jerusalem, in the temple precincts, specifically in the temple naos, in fact, in the Holy of Holies. And Antiochus IV did that back then. The cleansing of the temple from that incident is what the Jews celebrate to this very day called Hanukkah. And even Hanukkah is authenticated in the New Testament in John chapter 10, verse 22. But moving on. It's interesting that he blasphemes against God, yes, against God's name, dumb move, guy, and his tabernacle or temple. But he also blasphemes against somebody else that I think is kind of interesting. And them that dwell in heaven. Now, you can't build doctrine from this verse, but for those of us that understand from other passages that the church will be in heaven while this is going on, it's interesting that the Antichrist makes allusions to us in heaven. He blasphemed against them that dwell in heaven. That's an interesting phrase. Verse 7, and it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. There it is again. And power was given over him over all kindreds, tongues, and nations. Now, this overcoming the saints is mentioned, we saw in Daniel 7:21. It's mentioned in Daniel chapter 8, verse 12 and 24. It's mentioned in Daniel 11:31 and Revelation 11:7. And as you all recall, at Caesarea Philippi, in response to Peter's remarkable declaration of faith, who do you say that I am? Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus goes on then to explain that he's upon this, that is declaration of faith, he's going to build the church. A play on words with Petra and Peter, but if you understand the Greek structure of that, he's not referring to Peter, he's referring to what he did from the cases of the words. But anyway, the point is, he says, and the gates of hell shall not prevail over it, which is apparently, this is one of those places that a skeptic would say, well, there's a contradiction in the Bible. Because in Daniel 7, Daniel 8 twice, and Daniel 11, and Revelation 11:7 and 13:8, we have a contradiction to what Jesus said in Matthew 16. No, the contradiction only occurs if you assume that all saints and elect are equivalent to the church. Maybe the church is distinct. And it's in this manner, I'd like you to pause with me one more time. We've probably done this before, I realize, but let's go to Matthew 11. Jesus is speaking, and the context here has to be concerned by John the Baptist. In verse 11 of chapter 11, Jesus makes an interesting but a very emphatic remark. He says, verily I say unto you, among them that are born of women, there hath not risen a greater than John the Baptist. Notwithstanding, he that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. That's all in one verse. That's pretty breathtaking. Of all them that are born of women, there hath not risen any greater than John the Baptist. Now, obviously, Jesus is accepting himself, I infer. But the point is, that's quite a statement. In the sweep of that statement would be Noah, Moses, Abraham. Wow, that's quite a statement. And I believe Jesus says what he means and means what he says. But about the time you swallow that and understand it, you get to the next phrase. He adds, without catching his breath, notwithstanding, he that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. So whatever Jesus means at this moment by that phrase, it excludes John the Baptist. Does that mean John the Baptist is not saved? Hardly. And yet, it's a clue that not everyone has the same exact destiny. And this leads to a whole study that I encourage you to take on. And that is the significance of the body of Christ, the mystery of the church. So, we've talked about that before in several of the chapters, but I throw that out to encourage you to take a serious study of the origin, mission, and destiny of Israel in contrast to the origin, mystery, and destiny of the church. Very distinct, very different. But let's move on then to verse 8. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. In other words, the distinction gets very, very clear. You're not going to have any agnostics or atheists here. Either you're worshiping Christ under penalty of death, or you will be giving your worship to this incredible personage that I call the coming world leader. Now, them that dwell upon the earth, you need to be conscious, I'm sure you are by now, that that's a very specific code phrase, in a sense, of the book of Revelation. You and I should not be dwelling on the earth. Our citizenship is in heaven. The term there are those that dwell, that are embedded in, that dwell upon the earth, the cosmos, the world. And there are many. You can do a whole study of that. I'll leave that up to you. We'll move on. Verse 9, if any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. Interesting phrase. If any man have an ear, let him hear. That's all of us, huh? Echoes, of course, from chapters 2 and 3, in a sense. But it's interesting, we've been through 6 of these personages. We're about to get to the 7th. And if you notice the pattern in Revelation, every time there's a group of 7, there's 6 and then a parenthesis, a little remark or a couple of chapters, something, before the 7th. There's always 6, a break, and the 7th. And we even have it here, subtly placed, if you will, but verse 9 and 10 are sort of a footnote or an aside remark before getting to verse 11. Verse 11, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. Horns are authority, has the authority or dominion, and he spoke like a dragon. Now this particular beast is called here another beast, but we're going to find subsequent to this passage, this particular guy is spoken of as the false prophet. And when you get to chapter 16, verse 13, chapter 19, verse 20, and chapter 20, verse 10, you'll discover it'll speak of the beast and the false prophet. This duet from now on will be talked as the beast, referring to the first beast of chapter 13, and the false prophet. The false prophet is the implied label here in verse 11 through 18. Verse 12. And he exerciseth all the power or authority of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. Again, you see this, whose deadly wound was healed is the identity of the beast he's talking about. In other words, that's his way of discriminating who this first beast was. So it's not an incidental event, it's a major identifier. The second guy exercises all the power and authority of the first guy. The first guy is generally viewed by most commentators as a major global political ruler. And the second guy is sort of his John the Baptist or his promoter, but in a religious context. So if you think of a political leader on the one hand and a religious leader as a sidekick, that's the general impression most commentators have of this duet. And many writers, recognizing that Satan is behind them both, and that Satan's ambition, we learned from Isaiah 14 and also Ezekiel 28, Satan's ambition is to be worshipped like the Most High. His ambition is to be like God. Drawing upon that perspective, if you take Satan and his counterfeit Messiah, and his counterfeit Holy Spirit guy, if you will, you have what some writers call the Satanic Trinity. It's almost as if Satan, the first and second beast, the three of them together, constitute a counterfeit Trinity. At least in roles, in a sense, they match the Trinity as revealed in the Old and New Testaments. Or so it seems. So let's move on. Now, verse 13. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire to come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. That's pretty wild. Now, you can sort of dismiss that and say, well, that just means he can push buttons and send missiles. Maybe. But I think the passage is intentionally presenting the picture that he has supernatural power. He doeth great wonders. The same term that's used there is the term that's used for miracles in the Gospels. So he maketh fire to come down from heaven on the earth. It seems as if he is mimicking the miracles of the two witnesses, the two prophets of God of chapter 11. Remember, those two prophets of God in chapter 11 had four distinct powers. Call down fire from heaven, shut the heavens so it wouldn't rain, turn water into blood, and bring in plagues and such. Two of those powers were unique to Elijah, two of them unique to Moses, which we've reviewed. But the point is, it's as if he is attempting to simulate or equalize by doing equivalent kinds of things. This is exactly what happened, if you recall, in Exodus 7. You may recall that when Moses was before Pharaoh, we all remember the rather dramatic things Moses could do, but let's not forget the equal and almost equally dramatic things that the two priests of Pharaoh did. They also turned their staves into snakes. And you may recall, most people presume when they read that, they indulged in some kind of parlor trick. There are those, though, that believe it was not just parlor tricks. These people had bona fide occultic powers. The theologians will argue about that for a long time. But it's interesting that in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8, we have the names of those two guys. You don't find those in the Old Testament, but somehow Timothy knew who they were. Jannes and Jambres, these two guys. And makes an allusion to them. Now let's take a look at that. It might be instructive. 2 Timothy 3:8. Now as Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses, so do these also resist the truth, men of corrupt minds, reprobate concerning the faith. But they shall proceed no further, for their folly shall be manifest unto all men, as theirs also was. In other words, these two high priests of Pharaoh opposed Moses. And what's interesting, it wasn't a parlor trick that was exposed. Moses' snake ate the other two. And that's as if to demonstrate that both supernatural events, and yet, obviously, Moses, they recognize the significance of that themselves. They're terrified to realize that Moses' power, if you will, was superior to theirs. Now, obviously, the other thing that we have in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we have the craft and deceit of the Antichrist emphasized. It's interesting to remember, by the way, that it was prophecy, not miracles, that was Jesus' primary evidence. We don't ascribe Jesus Christ as the Son of God just because of the miracles. That's an important point, by the way. And in Matthew chapter 11, first half a dozen verses, that's become very clear. What's the reason we recognize Jesus Christ's deity is because he fulfilled prophecy. Because only God, the Father, knows the beginning from the end. The end from the beginning. Okay, verse 14. Now this guy continues, and he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had the power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. So it's the second guy, the second beast, the false prophet as he's later called, that does these miracles. I'm not saying he's the only one that does the miracles, but recognize that he has miraculous powers. There are some people that conjecture, and I share this with you only to keep your horizons as broad. There's two kinds of things that militate against this understanding. One is that we don't do our homework and even read it. But then there's also a risk, as we read it again and again and again and read the books, that our horizons may come too narrow, too myopic. There are some people that suspect that this leadership may have the apparent benefit of an alien connection. There's some people that suspect that maybe the packaging of Satan's deceit is in the form of really advanced technologies. That is in the form of some kind of communication with extraterrestrial intelligence. These are just speculations. You can build from these speculations all kinds of scenarios and so forth, and I won't go that far. But I share that with you to recognize that the New Agers and Satan's world itself will have very, very fancy packaging. Satan's world is never short on packaging. It will be in terms that will be obviously very contemporary at the time. But the goal of it is deceit. It's interesting. There are Christians who have done serious research on the whole UFO picture. Bill Allner's one. There's several other books. I haven't put a bibliography together. I probably should one of these times for the newsletter. But the point is, there are Christians that have done extensive research on the emergence of more and more UFO phenomena. What's interesting as you get into this is the discovery that everyone that's involved, everyone that certainly that has seen a UFO, certainly those that claim to have been abducted, all have had prior involvements with the occult. And near as the evidence seems to indicate that these things are on the one hand physical in a sense because they leave traces, and yet on the other hand they are paraphysical because they violate physical laws, make right angle turns at high speeds, all that sort of thing. And the only conclusion that one can come to is that they're demonic. And that is also exemplified by the message they carry, which is universally the same and universally anti-biblical. And so for that reason, it's an easy position to come to. But we should not be surprised if there's more and more of this kind of thing going to continue in future years. I can remember so vividly when I was on Walter Martin's board of directors. He was one of the greatest apologists alive at the time, certainly the greatest expert on comparative religions in America. And he was an expert in a number of areas of Christian doctrine. But he would love to get into the UFO picture because he had his views. And we used to just hope that when he got in the question and answer period after his presentations that somebody wouldn't ask a question about UFOs. Because we pleaded with him to leave that area alone because we felt it would discredit the ministry that he uniquely had been called to. But if given half a chance, he would always talk about men's hearts failing them for fear for the things which shall come upon the earth. And he'd always gesture with his hand like the saucer was handed. And we'd all stand in the back and wince and hope that we'd get off that subject. But it's interesting, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to this beast. And then there's the identity, which had the wound by a sword and did live. This wound by the sword, as if he's dead, rising back to life, is more than just an incident. It becomes an identity. And I'll explain why I think that's so important when we get to verse 18. But verse 15. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the beast should be killed. This is one of the reasons that many people see Daniel chapter 3 as a foreshadowing of the end times. You may recall in Daniel chapter 2, well, in Daniel chapter 1, Daniel and his three friends were deported as teenagers in the first captivity, the first deportation at Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. These four young men were taken to Babylon, put through postgraduate school to serve at court. And you may recall Nebuchadnezzar had his famous dream that troubled him, and Daniel came forth with his three friends in a dramatic way and interpreted that dream for them when all the wise men of Babylon couldn't cut it. In fact, they were given an execution order, but Daniel saved their bacon by, that's a bad expression for a good Jewish young boy, but anyway. Sorry about that, Daniel, by interpreting the dream. Now, if you know human nature, do you think those bureaucrats were pleased for having their life saved? No, they were upstaged before their boss, so they were going to get their revenge. In chapter 3, by then, Nebuchadnezzar's gotten on an ego trip, and he erects this gold image. Now, the image this time is not from its dream, which was four different metals. It was gold, all gold. He was gold. The image was all gold. I personally suspect, this text doesn't say this, I personally suspect his ego was fed and he was prompted to do this by these rivals of the Jewish advisors. And so you may recall the paraphrase quickly, Daniel chapter 3. Now, we got time. Let's go back to Daniel 3. Daniel is such fun because on the one hand it's so important and foundational. On the other hand, it's so colorful. It's so colorful. Chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar makes this image of gold. Verse 1, height was 80 cubits, the breadth was 6 cubits. In other words, roughly 9 feet wide and 90 feet high. So it probably wasn't a full man. It might have been an obelisk with a man on it or something. That's our speculation. Obviously, though, idiomatically spoke, is a fulfillment in Nebuchadnezzar's mind of his dream. Then he puts together and brings all the advisors in and all the rulers for the dedication of this image. Then verse 5, we have Nebuchadnezzar's ragtime band. We've got all that time to hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the sackbut, the psaltery, the dulcimer, and all kinds of music fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, has set up. And here's verse 6, and whosoever falls not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. By the way, they have found those furnaces. They found furnaces of that type. We did a CBS special, you may recall, primetime TV special on this whole bit and the recent scientific and archaeological discoveries supporting this. But let's move on here. And when the people heard all this music, all people and nations and languages, this wasn't just Babylonians, this was all that he ruled over, fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar set up. Now, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near, accused the Jews, and said, Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever, which is a greeting. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear, verse 10, the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the sackbut, the psaltery, the dulcimer, all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image, and whosoever it falls not down and worship, that he should be put in the midst of the fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. And of course, this rage and fury. We're in the book of Revelation. We are in chapter 14.
Revelation's Radio Network. Many hosts, one message of salvation. Revelation'sRadioNetwork.com.